the CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
You don't have to be a retail giant or government agency to be the victim of a costly data breach. If you run a website and collect customer data, your small to mid-sized business is just as likely to be targeted by hackers. The Barracuda Web Application Firewall provides cost-effective, instant security against automated and targeted attacks, making this WAF a must-have for your SMB. Reclaim your network. Try a Barracuda Web App Firewall risk-free at barracuda.com/WAF.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, CBS News correspondent Howard Arenstein.
It's just days away, the California primary, and after 6 months, the primary season is finally coming to an end. And the fight between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is as hot as the California summer. We'll have full details. Also, biblical flooding in Texas.
This is something we haven't seen in this area in 100 years.
A group of soldiers from Fort Hood among the casualties. And Jan Crawford on the case against Trump University.
Judge has been very unfair, has not done a good job. He's been a very bad judge. He's been
most defendants shy away from criticizing judges presiding over their cases, but not Donald Trump.
Plus Chip Reed on distractions for teenage drivers.
The top distraction for teens is other passengers, accounting for 15% of teen driver accidents.
But first to politics. Tuesday, there's voting in six states, including New Jersey and California, where we start our team coverage of the battle heating up between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton with correspondent Steve Futterman in San Jose, where fights broke out after a Trump rally.
There was pushing and shoving, punches and expletives. In what's also becoming a familiar scene, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton went after each other, using some of the strongest language so far in the campaign. Clinton, who promised a verbal attack on Trump, did just that in San Diego.
He is not just unprepared. He is temperamentally unfit to hold an office that requires knowledge, stability, and immense responsibility.
Here in San Jose, Trump responded.
The fact that they even allow her to participate in this race is a disgrace.
The presumptive Republican nominee was clearly upset by Clinton's tough talk, and he had some of his own.
After what she said about me today in her phony speech, that was a phony speech, I will say this, Hillary Clinton has to go to jail.
Steve Futterman, CBS News, San Jose, California.
On CBS This Morning, reporter Jeffrey Goldberg from The Atlantic talked about Clinton's tough speech on Thursday.
Yesterday's speech was not really a foreign policy speech. It was more like a psychiatric indictment of her opponent. I think that what she's going to do over the next 5 months is keep hammering that point home, that this man is not mentally stable.
More on Hillary Clinton's speech and Donald Trump's reaction from correspondent Nancy Cordes.
I watched Hillary today. It was pathetic.
The speech Trump found pathetic was exactly what Democrats had been waiting to hear.
Anything Obama wants, she's going forward with, because you know why? She doesn't want to go to jail. That's why, folks.
Clinton had given a point-by-point critique of what she called Trump's dangerously incoherent ideas.
They're not even really ideas, just a series of bizarre rants, personal feuds, and outright lies.
She said he is too cavalier about U.S. alliances.
NATO is obsolete.
Even as he praises brutal dictators like Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
He wiped out the uncle. He wiped out this one, that one. I mean, this guy doesn't play games.
I will leave it to the psychiatrist to explain his affection for tyrants.
The former Secretary of State argued Trump is too erratic, too hot-tempered for a job that requires a cool head.
Bragging, mocking, composing nasty tweets. I'm willing to bet he's writing a few right now.
Actually, he only sent two during the speech, accusing her of incompetence and reading poorly from the teleprompter.
To watch her is like Sominex. You ever hear of Sominex? Sleep all night. Bing.
Clinton's Democratic opponent Bernie Sanders agreed with her assessment of Trump, but said Clinton has her own weaknesses on foreign policy, including her vote for the war in Iraq and her support for regime change in Libya, which has had mixed results.
Clinton cut short a New Jersey campaign swing to return to California. Before she left the Garden State, Clinton went after the now-defunct Trump University.
This is just more evidence that Donald Trump himself is a fraud. He is trying to scam America the way he scammed all those people at Trump U.
Clinton is now staying put here in California through next Tuesday's primary, and so, it appears, is Sanders, who has already spent about half the month here. The irony is that Clinton will probably clinch the final delegates she needs for the nomination Tuesday from other states that are voting before they even finish counting the votes here in California.
They're going to say, the nominating process is over. Secretary Clinton has won. That is factually incorrect.
California's two-term governor, Jerry Brown, stepped in Tuesday, handing Clinton a key endorsement. The longtime liberal said he was deeply impressed with how well Bernie Sanders has done, but that Clinton has the tenacity and skill to advance the Democratic agenda.
That from Nancy Cordes in California. Now correspondent Major Garrett reports Donald Trump has finally picked up an important establishment endorsement.
In March, House Speaker Paul Ryan issued this warning to Trump.
This party does not prey on people's prejudices.
But on Thursday, Ryan became the latest high-profile Republican to line up behind him.
My goal is to make sure that we're unified so that we're at full strength in the fall so that we can actually win the election.
Major Garrett also reported this week that Trump held a contentious news conference in New York to release the names of veterans groups that received donations he raised earlier this year in Iowa.
The money Donald Trump raised for veterans is real. So are the organizations that received it. Just as real, Trump's contempt for reporters who tried to follow the money.
I'm going to continue to attack the press. I've watched you on television. You're a real beauty. This sleazy guy right over here from ABC, he's a sleaze.
Why do you resent just the verification process that is natural?
Because I wanted to make this out of the goodness of my heart. I didn't want to do this where the press is all involved. And all of a sudden, everybody's going, where did it go? Who did it go to?
Trump has said repeatedly he raised $6 million for veterans' charities. But it wasn't until last week he made good on his own pledge to donate $1 million.
This is my check for $1 million.
Trump's volatile approach continues to fuel speculation about an independent challenge drawn from inside Republican ranks. One name that's floating out there in sort of an ethereal way is David French, a writer for the conservative National Review, who's never held elective office.
Just 38,000 jobs created in the month of May.
Senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. And that weak job report on Friday could have an impact on this year's election.
This is the weakest report since September of 2010 for job creation. The unemployment rate down at 4.7%. That is the lowest since November of 2007, but probably not for the right reasons, probably because people were on the sidelines not seeking employment.
Coming up, a lockdown after a shooting at UCLA and what you should know about Zika.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On Wednesday, shots were heard at the UCLA campus and officials immediately ordered a lockdown. Correspondent Carter Evans reports the shooting turned out to be what officials called a murder-suicide, a student shooting a respected and well-liked professor.
Maynuk Sirkar killed 39-year-old engineering professor William Scott Klug before taking his own life. Students, in the midst of finals week, filed out of classrooms and buildings with their hands up.
And then there's a police officer. He was like yelling at us to get out with a machine gun.
Campus police instructed students and staff to find a secure place.
But our doors open outward, so it was very hard to try to lock it because it didn't have a lock.
Sirkar left a note here at the scene of the shooting asking police to check on his cat in Minnesota. It was there that they found his kill list with three names, Professor Klug, an unidentified UCLA professor, and Ashley Hastie, Sirkar's estranged wife. She was found dead in her home. Police believe Sircar killed her before driving to Los Angeles to confront the two professors, but he was only able to find one.
That from Carter Evans in Los Angeles. CBS's Manuel Bajorquez reports now that the rain in Texas just won't stop.
The sound of pounding rain has become the daily chorus across the state of Texas. Wednesday's storms targeted north of Houston, where a 6-inch downpour in just 3 hours led to flash flooding. It was a similar scene further north in Lubbock, where drivers slogged through washed-out streets. In the southeast, the overflowing Brazos River stranded cows in deep water as they struggled to reach higher ground. The river continues to consume homes and land. It's climbed to nearly 10 feet above flood stage near Richmond. Emergency crews have carried out more than 450 water rescues.
This is something we haven't seen in this area in 100 years.
Mary Dotterell's home is already in nearly 3 feet of water as this area braces for more rain.
Correspondent Manuel Bajorquez. David Begno reports at Fort Hood, Texas, 5 soldiers died and 4 were still missing on Friday in runaway floods.
12 troops were inside of a tactical vehicle during a Thursday morning training exercise when their 2.5-ton truck was washed away from a low water crossing. The vehicle overturned, setting off a desperate search and rescue effort. So far, the 3 soldiers rescued are in stable condition. Heavy rains have battered Central Texas and the Fort Hood area in recent days.
Oh my God, no.
This driver in Granbury near Fort Worth drove into an overflowing creek. The fast-moving water overtook the vehicle and pinned it against a tree.
Get out! Get out! Get out!
The driver and the passenger were able to climb out of the submerged vehicle unharmed.
Correspondent David Begno in Texas. In many cases, rain and pools of water lead to breeding mosquitoes. And mosquitoes this year mean the danger of the Zika virus. With a baby born this past week with microcephaly in New Jersey to a mother who picked up Zika in Honduras, officials are very concerned. On CBS This Morning, Nora O'Donnell, Charlie Rose, and Gail King spoke about the risks with Tom Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control.
First, let me ask you, Dr. Frieden, what challenges does a baby face who has been diagnosed with Zika?
There's really a broad range of abnormalities that children who are affected by Zika have had. Some are so severely ill that they're not able to survive past a few days. Others may be relatively normal. But the real plain truth is we have to do everything possible to protect pregnant women. That's the bottom line with Zika.
If, in fact, you have contracted the virus, what are the chances that your baby will be born with microcephaly?
The estimates are that between 1 and 13% of infants born to mothers who were infected in the first trimester may have a small head or microcephaly. But one thing we still don't understand is, for the children who don't have small heads, are they going to have abnormalities? And that's something that we may not know for months or years.
What are you most concerned about as we head into the summer and mosquito season? Everybody says, it's coming here, get ready.
Summer is heating up, and so is Zika. We've already seen one case of dengue in Florida. That's earlier than we usually see. We've now seen the first case of chikungunya, a similarly spread virus in Texas. It's very important that we move forward rapidly. Mm-hmm. Congress did the right thing with Ebola, and I hope they will do the right thing with Zika, and the sooner the better. We need to start the long-term projects to better support pregnant women, come up with better ways to diagnose the infection, come up with better ways to control the mosquito. All of that requires congressional action.
Tom Frieden of the CDC on CBS This Morning. In other medical news, the government is trying to make sure we all cut back on salt.
I'm Barry Bagnetto in Washington. 6 years after an Institute of Medicine report urged the nation to kick its salt habit, the Food and Drug Administration is proposing sodium limits for about 150 categories of processed food, part of a two-step strategy aimed at reducing consumption to about a teaspoon a day in 10 years. Currently, 9 out of 10 Americans take in too much sodium, raising their risks of high blood pressure, heart attack, and stroke.
This approach is expected to achieve significant reductions in sodium while providing flexibility for industry and more choice
prices for consumers.
Dr. Rob Califf says he has a unique understanding of the problem, not just as FDA commissioner. He's also a cardiologist who has hypertension himself. He argues a one-size-fits-all approach won't work for food makers.
What you need to do if you're making cheese as opposed to bread or vegetables is quite different.
There are no mandatory requirements for food companies. That doesn't bother American Heart Association President Dr. Mark Krieger.
They understand it's the right thing to do, and there's many things they can do to ensure that the taste is still good.
Right now, in fact, many companies are reducing salt without any fanfare or complaints. Many consumers don't even notice a big difference. Dr. Krieger says Americans do need help keeping sodium out of the kitchen.
It is a problem. They don't have the choice if the foods they're buying are already loaded with salt.
Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
And Heather Bosch reports on a kid in Massachusetts who called the police on his dad for going through a red light.
Robbie Richardson knows something about traffic lights.
Green means go, and yellow means slow, and red means stop.
Which is why the Massachusetts boy complained when his dad, Mike, turned right on red.
And he tells me, hey, Dad, you just went through a red light. And I says, no, Robbie, you can go through that one. As long as you stop and there's nobody coming, you can go.
Robbie was not convinced and turned Dad in.
911, what's your emergency?
Daddy went past a red light.
Yeah.
It was in the brand new car, my mommy's car.
Dispatcher Mike Bowes.
Then I want to check on the father to make sure that the father was okay because he ran the light in his mother's new car.
Hello?
Hi, Quincy Police.
I am just trying to apologize. That's my 5-year-old son.
Well, let us know you ran a red light.
Oh, no.
Considerate practice, Dad, the little guy says.
I like being an officer.
He wants to be a police officer. Heather Bosch, CBS News.
Coming up, a closer look at charges that Trump University was a scam and a warning about distractions for teenage drivers this summer.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
Hello, I'm Jerry Mathers. I was the Beaver in Leave It to Beaver. And 20 years ago, I almost died from type 2 diabetes. When I was diagnosed with type 2, I was shocked. My blood sugar was through the roof. Now, the very same natural remedies I use to control my type 2 diabetes are available for you in a super easy program called the Diabetes Solution Kit. And I should know it works. I use the very same techniques to drop 40 pounds of fat, get my blood sugar under control, and watch my type 2 diabetes fade into thin air. If you have diabetes, I urge you to try this step-by-step plan. It has all the natural techniques I used, and it works a lot faster, too. I'm Jerry Mathers, and if I can do it, you can do it, too.
If you'd like to normalize your blood sugar and stop taking your diabetes medication completely with your doctor's approval, go to diabetic44.com. That's diabetic44.com. Reverse your diabetes in as little as 30 days by going to diabetic44.com. That's diabetic44.com now.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Tuesday marks the California primary and voting in 5 other states. But the basic choice in November seems to be Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. Republican pollster Frank Luntz, a CBS News consultant, spoke about what he calls the election from hell with Charlie Rose, Nora O'Donnell, and Gail King on CBS This Morning.
We have identified a segment, and it's called None of the Above. And it focuses on those people who do not like Hillary Clinton, who do not like Donald Trump, reject both individuals equally and very harshly, but they're definitely going to vote. And the number one attribute that they're looking for is trust and integrity.
You think they will determine the outcome of this race?
Absolutely. It's not soccer moms. It's not NASCAR dads. It's this 11%. And they believe that neither candidate has the honesty and integrity that they're looking for. And therefore, it's the candidate that they distrust the least will end up with their vote.
Is it too late for an independent candidate to get in?
It's not too late. Mike Bloomberg could jump back in again, and I believe he would start with over 20% of the vote. If Bernie Sanders decided that he was mistreated by the Democratic Party, he would start with over 20% of the vote. This is not just an angry and frustrated election. I want to give you a specific word, betrayal. These are people who feel that Wall Street betrayed them economically, that Washington betrayed them politically, and they have no place to turn. They're in their 50s and 60s. They look towards the future with tremendous pessimism. They don't believe that America is going to be the greatest country down the road.
It would be too late to file in Texas and other places, so therefore, it's a fool's errand.
Except that Texas is going to go Republican no matter who files there, no matter who is running there. The key states, those states that are decided by less than 5% of the vote, those filing deadlines are not until August or September. I want to make one more point. This negativity, this pessimism is so deep, and it concerns me because these two conventions, I'm afraid of the violence that could happen outside the conventions.
At both conventions,
that people no longer know that line of where to stop, that they feel justified not just in voicing their opposition to the candidates, but doing so physically and even violently.
Republican pollster Frank Luntz on CBS This Morning. Donald Trump has been criticizing the judge involved in a lawsuit against Trump University. Some students charged the courses they took were expensive scams. The judge ordered the release of documents, which correspondent Jan Crawford has been reading.
Trump's lawyers argued that these playbooks contain trade secrets, and they fought to keep them under seal. But the judge disagreed. He said there was no compelling reason to keep these documents away from the public.
Judge has been very unfair, has not done a good job. He's been a very bad judge. He's been
most defendants shy away from criticizing judges presiding over their cases, but not Donald Trump. Last week, in another tirade, the Republican presidential candidate called federal judge Gonzalo Curiel a hater and even brought up his ethnicity.
The judge, who happens to be, we believe, Mexican, which is great. I think that's fine.
In ordering the 2009 and 2010 playbooks released, Judge Curiel did not avoid Trump's personal attacks, noting the billionaire placed the integrity of these court proceedings at issue. Potential students were invited to free workshops where they were offered additional courses, one package costing almost $35,000. To those worried about the costs, salesmen were told to say, most students who are invited into this program use established lines of credit to handle tuition. Former student Gary Smith told CBS's Juliana Goldman he spent thousands on Trump University.
They said to call the credit card companies and make a request and try not to take no as the answer.
Before closing in 2010, Trump University promised to teach students the real estate tycoon's investment techniques. The manuals gave Trump University employees tips on the psychology of the sale, noting that clients must apply and be accepted to our program. Those with incomes more than $90,000 a year and net worths over $200,000 were prime targets.
That's what it's all about, success. It's going to happen to you.
Now, the Trump camp has insisted that complaints about the university came from just a small number of former students. But New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, a Democrat, says otherwise, and he is suing Trump University. He told CBS, the playbooks tell us what our investigation uncovered and what we alleged in our lawsuit. Trump University was a fraud that harmed thousands of individuals.
Correspondent Jen Crawford. Now correspondent Chip Reed on a new AAA report on the distractions for teen drivers this summer.
You know, when you think of distracted driving in teenagers, you probably think of the cell phone. But this new study says that with teen drivers, the distraction often comes from passengers.
During the summer months, more teenagers are on the road, and the number of deaths from crashes involving teen drivers soars to an average of 10 every day, 16% higher than the rest of the year. Over the past 8 years, AAA, working with the University of Iowa, studied teen drivers using dashboard cameras and documenting more than 2,200 moderate to severe collisions. Over that time, they saw a disturbing change in behavior. Jennifer Ryan is with AAA.
They're more likely to interact with their phones via texting or social media, which is particularly scary because they're actually then looking down and taking their eyes off the road.
The study says today nearly 60% of teen crashes involve distracted driving. But perhaps surprisingly, they found that cell phones are not the number one problem. No, the top distraction for teens is other passengers, accounting for 15% of teen driver accidents. 12% were distracted by texting or talking on a cell phone.
What we know about teens is that when they add a passenger, they're more likely to be distracted, they're more likely to engage in risky behavior.
I miss both of my daughters so much.
Stacy Robinson lost two daughters in a crash in Texas in March. A teenage friend who was driving was looking at her phone moments before hitting an 18-wheeler head-on.
This device also could only take a moment, and your life can be changed.
Now, Teron Wooldridge, the brother of the two girls, spreads the word about the dangers of distracted driving.
The best way that I can honor my sisters, the best way I know possible, is to talk to youth and talk to parents and help them to understand what could happen.
AAA says nearly two-thirds of the people injured or killed in crashes involving teen drivers are not the teen drivers. They're passengers in that car or people in other cars.
Correspondent Chip Reed. And if you are driving or plan to drive soon, listen to our commentator, Charles Grodin.
58,000 people were killed on the United States highways during the Vietnam War. That's more people than we lost in the war. No doubt in many cases, alcohol was involved. That's why when I saw a recent ad for a whiskey that had a car company's name attached to it, I thought it was a bad idea. Please, don't drink and drive. The life you save may very well be your own. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
And I'm Howard Arenstein in Washington.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Raviv.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's Dan Raviv.
In the U.S. economy, does the little guy or the little gal have much of a chance to get ahead? That's something considered by Tamara Drought, who's with a liberal organization called Demos, thinking about the U.S. economy. You're the author of a book called Sleeping Giant, How the New Working Class Will Transform America. Tamara Drought, what's the new working class? What do they do?
The working class today is much different than the old industrial working class, which we think of as, you know, mostly white men, blue-collar workers. And we've had this big shift where the working class has really gone from the center being about making stuff to today it's really about serving people. So the types of jobs have changed and who is doing those jobs has changed. So today's working class is much more female and much more racially diverse. And what I talk about in the book is how that has led us for a long time now to sort of forget about the working class, except every 4 years when it's an election like it is now, and we start talking about the working class again. But we're often just talking about white working class men and not this vibrant new working class who are childcare workers, our home health aides, retail workers, fast food workers.
In your book, you do say there's a lot of talk about the middle class, and that's what I hear the candidates saying. They rarely say working class. Frankly, Bernie Sanders perhaps used the phrase in part because he's a self-described democratic socialist. But, you know, beyond that, we always hear about the middle class. And you write that that's kind of distorting the argument.
It is distorting the argument because the reality is what has happened is the middle class has become pretty much a professional class. It has gotten so much harder to work or educate your way into the middle class. So having a bachelor's degree or higher has pretty much become the minimum ticket required. So it's a professional class. The majority of workers in this country do not have bachelor's degrees. They work for wages. Half of all workers earn less than $15 an hour. So the majority of people in this country are indeed working class. And we've been sold this idea that, well, everybody identifies as middle class. Frankly, though, that is fundamentally not true. And in fact, the percentage of people who identify as working class and as middle class have been split evenly for at least the last two, three decades.
Well, a lot of people who know history remember Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, and his New Deal. Your book has a clarion call for what you call a better deal. Give us a brief description of that.
Yeah, it's time that we really modernize our social contract in this country, and it's really been since the New Deal that we've done that. So it really is aimed at bringing our society really into the 21st century, investing in infrastructure, investing in things like childcare and debt-free college, and finally, modernizing our elections and really making sure that we are protecting the freedom to vote in this country.
Yet your subtitle says how the new working class will transform America, and sometimes even in the arguments that you make in your book, I'm thinking, You're trying to persuade an elite, the middle class, maybe the ruling class, that they ought to be nicer to the working class.
One of the things that was so apparent in the interviews I did in this book is just the amount of disrespect that the working class is under, both on the job and also in their workplace and in society. You know, I had a commercial sanitation truck driver who summed it up. He said, "I feel like the working class are the lepers of society, needed to carry out the economy and make it strong, but totally disregarded when it comes to our needs." And I think we all play a role in remembering that all work has dignity and value in this country.
That's Tamara Drought, a vice president at Demos, author of a book you may have noticed called Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. This one's called Sleeping Giant. Tamara Drought, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Now, a fish story, and it's something that's far bigger and global than you might have thought. There are people who are collectors, and they just won't quit till they get the most gorgeous, most valuable tropical fish. Emily Voigt is a journalist who's become an expert on all this for your book, published by a subsidiary of CBS, Simon & Schuster. The name of the book, The Dragon Behind the Glass. It says a true story of power, obsession, and the world's most coveted fish. Emily Voigt, what's the fish at the center of your story?
The Asian arowana, it's the world's most expensive aquarium fish. So it's a tropical freshwater fish from Southeast Asia. And if you're picturing something like a goldfish or a guppy, you're way off. It is huge. It grows about 3 feet long in the wild, and it's a very fierce predator. In fact, people call it the dragon fish because it looks a bit like the Chinese dragon. It has very large scales and whiskers and kind of ripples as it swims. And that association has led to the belief that it brings prosperity and good luck. And for that reason, it's been largely overfished in the wild. It's protected by the U.S. Endangered Species Act and illegal to bring into the country as a pet.
Oh, I see. I wanted to get to that right away, whether all of this trade in tropical fish, all right, specifically the Asian arowana, whether it's legal if you label it somehow that it's not your pet. Is there a legal way to buy one in Asia and bring it into the U.S., into my home if I have an enormous tank?
Well, you know, not the Asian arowana. It can't be brought into the U.S. as a pet, but it is legal in most other countries in the world. So it's actually farmed. I call it a mass-produced endangered species because while it's mostly extirpated from the wild, it's actually farmed by the hundreds of thousands each year.
Well, where does that take place?
It happens in Southeast Asia. So the farms are sometimes compared to high-security prisons. They have high concrete walls and barbed wire and guard dogs that prowl the perimeters at night.
No, seriously, just for raising valuable fish? Really? Just for fish?
Yeah, just for this fish. And, you know, there's good reason for the security, because a wave of fish robberies has been sweeping the region for the past decade or so.
Well, is this entire business, including the criminal activity, totally away from America? I know your book takes us to places like Singapore.
No, you know, it doesn't just involve non-Americans. I first heard about the fish, in fact, right here in New York City, from a pet detective. I was accompanying him to the South Bronx to investigate reports of a pet alligator up there. And we didn't find the alligator, but he told me all about these fish that were coming into the city that were kind of the bane of his existence. And that is how I got turned on to the story. He had very interesting stories about, for example, Wall Street bankers breaking down in tears when their illicit pet fish is confiscated. And sort of the black market appeal, I think, is a draw to a lot of people in the United States.
And by the way, one Asian arowana could sell for how much?
The fish really varies in price quite considerably. It's a lot like the art market. So it matters what kind of color variety you have and so forth. The red is the most desirable. They start in the range of about $1,000, and prices go up from there. The record prices are usually said to be in the six figures. Now, for example, I heard about a fish that supposedly fetched $300,000 from a high-ranking member of the Chinese government. I couldn't confirm that, but I did, in my reporting, go to Taiwan to visit a plastics mogul who claims that his albino arowana cost $150,000.
The world's most coveted fish is the Asian arowana. There's a lot of stuff like that in this book, The Dragon Behind the Glass. That's the author, Emily Voigt. Emily, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup, after this short break.
Listen to the news right now in your car with the CBS Radio News app. Just download our free app to your iOS or Android device to stream the news you need on Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. Listen to the latest news right now or to your favorites like Face the Nation and the Weekend Roundup. The CBS Radio News app. Download it on your phone now to use in Apple CarPlay and Android Auto today.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Lots of people on ocean beaches now that June is here and the warm weather is spreading through the nation. But when people go to the beach, often shark bites follow. One of the worst incidents happened in California at Corona Del Mar. Correspondent Carter Evans went to the beach to investigate.
Still no swimming allowed at the beach where a shark attacked 52-year-old Maria Corchmaros on Sunday. She was training for a triathlon, swimming about 500 feet offshore when the shark struck.
She had extensive lacerations to her right arm.
Dr. Umberto Sari says Corchmaros will survive, but a shark left a very large bite mark.
It extends from upper torso area down to the pelvis.
A lot of these sharks spend most of their time literally 100 feet off the beach.
Marine biologist Chris Lowe has been tracking the growing shark population off Southern California for more than a decade. Lowe says the number of juvenile great whites in the area is rising significantly. They're drawn to warm water here caused by El Nino and an abundance of fish to feed on. They also have no predators, and great whites are a protected species.
The questions that we're trying to answer now are, why are they at these beaches? How long do they stay at these beaches? What makes this beach so much more special than that beach?
Lowe says the 6 to 7 foot long juvenile great whites are skittish and usually stay away from swimmers. But with more sharks and more people in the water,
I think the rate of shark attack is going to continue to go up. And the reason for that is simple math.
Now, doctors tell me the bite mark on this woman was 18 inches wide. Experts say that means this was likely an adult great white shark, at least 10 feet long.
Correspondent Carter Evans on the beach in California. Over the Memorial Day weekend, officials at the Cincinnati Zoo chose to kill a 17-year-old male gorilla named Harambe when a 3-year-old boy fell into its enclosure and appeared to be in danger. Correspondent Jamie Yukas reports from Cincinnati that animal rights protesters are upset about what they see as the unnecessary death.
The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden is the second oldest zoo in the country, and critics say it's time for a security upgrade, while the zoo maintains its exhibits are safe.
Investigators are trying to figure out how a young boy ended up in the grasp of a more than 420-pound gorilla. The encounter, which resulted in zoo officials killing Harambe, is igniting a discussion over zoo security. Ed Hansen is the CEO of the American Association of Zookeepers.
Safety protocols for zoos are thoroughly vetted.
According to the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or the AZA, exhibits where animals and visitors are not supposed to come in contact need to have at least one substantial barrier, such as a guardrail or fence in place.
Secondary barriers, such as guardrails and things like that, are normally covered with vegetation. Those barriers are constructed of wire or piping or some similar material. And in this case, those barriers look like a climbing apparatus or a jungle gym to a child.
The child made his way past a 3-foot fence, through several feet of bushes, and down a 15-foot moat.
The exhibit's safe and the barrier's safe.
The zoo has repeatedly defended their security.
They need to make that place safe.
But critics such as Michael Budke, a co-founder of the activist group Stop Animal Exploitation Now, disagrees.
Clearly there are issues with this enclosure. Federal regulations require enclosures within facilities like zoos have both perimeter fences and physical barriers, which are designed not only to keep the animals in, but to keep the public out.
The group filed a complaint with the USDA Monday, claiming the Cincinnati Zoo violated the Animal Welfare Act. They point out that the zoo has had incidents in the past, including one in March when two polar bears escaped from their inner enclosure For about 2 hours, no one was hurt.
And although the Cincinnati Zoo is standing by its decision, they too are mourning the gorilla, along with Jerry Stones, who took care of Harambe for the first 15 years of his life.
He was not mean. He was a gentle little guy. And an unforeseen circumstance was born, and he had to lose.
That from correspondent Jamie Yukas. Now, correspondent Manuel Bajorquez reports from Austin, Texas, on a computer that's composing music according to human moods.
This is IBM's Watson. It's listening and then writing an original song tailored to a specific mood.
So it listens to this piece and it deconstructs this piece of music, learns from it, and gets inspired by it.
Computer scientist Janani Makuta built the Watson Beat program here at IBM's Austin, Texas campus.
And then it adds on top of it the layer of emotion that you wanted to portray.
To say something is happy or sad really depends on the person.
To some degree, yes. We can only take it so far.
Musician Richard Daskus is teaching Watson to convey emotions by training it to recognize musical patterns. Happy or upbeat songs are more likely to be based on major chords. Sad is typically expressed in a minor key.
This is revolutionary, you think?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, this is kind of the cutting edge of music.
Music has been moving into the digital age for decades. Technology has created more efficient recording methods and spawned an entire genre of computer-generated beats. But Watson songs are the first digital works based on mood. Researchers hope anyone will be able to use Watson Beat just by opening an app.
So this is an instance of Watson.
Rob High is Watson's chief technology officer.
What can Watson Beat do better than a human being?
Watson Beat is not constrained by normal human biases. And those biases can actually get in our way.
Is it meant to replace humans as the composers and creators of music?
Nothing's going to replace humans in our human creativity, but certainly we can be augmented.
Watson is learning to process massive amounts of data, medical compounds, legal briefs, even recipes, faster than the human brain. But Watson's new grasp on human emotions in music could be a breakthrough in the race to perfect artificial intelligence.
The new realm of AI is all about teaching computers to be creative. And music is the most creative language that everyone can understand.
From information, future inspiration. Manuel Bajorquez, Austin, Texas.
Thanks for being with us, and anytime you want to hear us, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. You'll find our podcasts also on iTunes and other podcast services, and our app for your smartphone is CBS Radio News. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein.